Nuclear Anniversaries, Part 1. The first atomic bomb blast in history took place on July 16, 1945, in New Mexico at the Jornada del Muerto Valley, which translates into Dead Man's Trail and is more commonly known now as the Trinity Site. The area was chosen by General Leslie Groves, head of the Manhattan Project to build the atomic bomb, because he considered it remote and uninhabited. But people lived in that area, lived off the land as they had for generations. And once that bomb exploded and dropped its radioactive fallout on the land, the water, the animals, and the people, nothing was ever the same. This week, most media will commemorate that first A-bomb explosion as an event that happened 80 years ago and has little importance today beyond being a marker in nuclear history. But then a genuine expert on the Trinity explosion and the rest of what happened in nuclear New Mexico informs you.
With Trinity and with the Manhattan Project and some of these things, we're talking about a history from 80 years ago. But this is in no way, shape, or form history to be forgotten in the past. We are still living this. It is still contemporary.
And then she goes on to explain exactly why. Well, when author Mariah Gomez, a New Mexico nuclear history expert, fills in the picture of what's still happening to people as a result of that first atomic bomb blast and the radiation that followed, you begin to understand the unending, unrelenting, ongoing, and agonizing legacy that put us in that awful, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a special program marking the 80th anniversary of the first atomic bomb explosion on July 16, 1945. It happened at the Trinity Site in New Mexico. We'll talk with Mariah Gomez, author of the book Nuclear Nuevo México, Colonialism and the Effects of the Nuclear Industrial Complex on Nuevo Mexicanos. She goes into detail about how decisions made about the first A-bomb blast and its follow-up were steered by the embedded prejudices of environmental racism towards the people who lived there. We'll also talk with Bernice Gutierrez, who was born only 8 days before the Trinity blast and only 35 miles away from Ground Zero. She explains the legacy of the bomb on the health of 5 generations of her family and her activism and research into resulting infant mortality rates. Then Tina Cordova, a downwinder and the intrepid leader of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium, explains both the triumph and the failings of the recently passed extension and expansion of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA. Then I'll chime in with a tale of media manipulation on all things nuclear that began before the Trinity blast and continues to this day. Time permitting, we'll have some information on that other July 16 nuclear disaster in New Mexico, the 1979 Church Rock uranium tailings spill on Navajo Nation land that still has not been cleaned up. All of this coming up right now. Today is Tuesday, July 15, 2025, and here is this week's special report on the 80th anniversary of the first atomic bomb detonation at the Trinity Site in New Mexico. The Trinity atomic bomb blast on July 16, 1945, is usually reported on with 4th of July-style huzzas for the power of the United States, the rocket's red glare, and macho military muscle posing. Very little attention is ever put on the victims of that blast, with consequences that continue to this day. That's where Nuclear Hot Seat is going to take you with this show in a series of interviews. First, Mariah Gomez. She is from northern New Mexico and author of the 2022 book Nuclear Nuevo México, Colonialism and the Effects of the Nuclear Industrial Complex on Nuevo Mexicanos. It was awarded a Southwest Book Award and an International Latino Book Award. I spoke with Mariah Gomez just this morning, July 15, 2025. Mariah Gomez, thanks so much for joining us here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Hi, Libby. Thanks so much for having me.
You wrote a book entitled Nuclear Nuevo New Mexico. What is the nature of the information there?
So Nuclear Nuevo Mexico really looks at the effects of the Nuevo Mexicano population, so the Hispanic population in New Mexico, the effects of the nuclear industrial complex on that population.
You focus in on the Trinity explosion and provide information that is not generally known or available about it. First of all, why did the government choose this as the area where they decided they were going to explode an atomic bomb?
That's a good question. And I think that one of the reasons why the Trinity site was selected as it was, first of all, has to do with Los Alamos and the fact that the Project Wire Site Y had been selected for Los Alamos, and they needed a site reasonably close to Project Y Site Y for the Trinity test. Essentially, what happened was Los Alamos was selected. It didn't meet the criteria that they had laid out for that particular site, except that they had a reasonable availability of labor. And they made a labor force, a blue-collar workforce, out of the local Nuevo Mexicano and Tewa populations. And so once they started Site Y in Los Alamos and they needed a site for Trinity, you know, it was a similar process. They had selected several sites. They chose the Trinity site primarily because the White Sands Proving Grounds was nearby, and they were able to use part of that for the Trinity test. But part of the narrative that gets misrepresented is that the Trinity site was remote and uninhabited. And while the Proving Grounds themselves, which were military operated and owned, were remote and uninhabited, it was essentially a military facility. The nearby villages, Nuevo Mexicano villages, which are small villages throughout New Mexico, were not uninhabited nor remote. And there were people living as close as 12 miles away from the Trinity blast.
You use the term environmental racism, and of course, it's been batted around a lot. What is the definition of environmental racism?
Environmental racism is the specific targeting of communities of color for industries that are polluting, industries that are known to make people sick or harm people, sometimes resulting in death. There are other parts of environmental racism that are sometimes left out, like the failure to include Black, Indigenous, people of color at the table when creating laws or other sorts of regulations that have to do with regulating these industries and the communities that are so often targeted and impacted the most, frontline communities, are left out. And so when I write about Trinity tests and the Trinity site and environmental racism, I'm looking at both the ways that this area was targeted for the test and also the ways that the New Mexico or the Trinity downwinders, and I want to return to that. We use Trinity downwinders, but really the testing, the nuclear testing started about a year prior to Trinity in northern New Mexico, with the RALA test, the radioactive lanthanum tests. And so the policymaking aspect of that is the fact that until 2 weeks ago, or a week ago, I guess, July 3rd, New Mexico downwinders have been omitted, consciously omitted, from the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. So that also is part of environmental racism, as have Marshall Islanders, Pacific Islanders, as have uranium workers, primarily indigenous uranium workers, post-1971 who have been omitted. That is all part of environmental racism.
There obviously was no warning given that something was about to happen, let alone the nature of it, because the Manhattan Project, the building of the bomb, was completely top secret. What, if any, follow-up was done to either assist or study those people who were impacted?
There was virtually no follow-up. One of the things that I write about is I look at some of the studies that were conducted after the test, and one of the conclusions that I come to is that the dogs who were nearby were actually studied more than the people. And that's to say that there was a team from, I believe it was UCLA, who came and conducted studies, and they were really fascinated by the radiation burns that the dogs and the other animals had on their paws. Were really familiar. People who are familiar with the Trinity test in the story know about the cows, the irradiated cows that turned white, right? But the people were not studied. There was a very short period of time where they came back and they checked to see if people were okay. But of course, we know now, and they were not curious enough to investigate it then, that one of the effects of high-level radiation fallout is these long-term effects, and there's a latency period in how it takes cancer and other illnesses, in particular these illnesses that are known to be radiogenic, there's a latency period that it takes it to develop. And so, lo and behold, all of these people in southern New Mexico around the Trinity test became sick. They became sick with radiogenic cancers and other illnesses known to be related to exposure, overexposure to radiation, ionizing radiation. And now we have 80 years later, people who are still suffering because of genetic epigenetic inheritance.
Other than direct exposure to fallout, meaning at the time of the explosion, what are the other ways that Nuevo Mexicanos and Mexicanas were exposed to radiation? You list 8 in total in the book.
In terms of thinking about the pathways to contamination for ionizing radiation, one of the things that's interesting about this population in New Mexico in the 1940s, and it's not just for southern New Mexico, but also for northern New Mexico where the Rolla tests occurred, the fallout contaminated the air, the soil, the water. And these are people who were living agricultural land-based lifestyles in the 1940s, and many still do today. For example, when we're thinking about water, the primary method of irrigation was through the acequia system. And the acequia system, which is a ditch irrigation system, collects water, or there's water that comes from a main runoff, whether it's a mountain range, etc. And that water is then used to water plants and water fields and sometimes feed animals. The other sort of water impact was that there was no running water, and so people used cisterns. And so those cisterns gathered water. They also gathered fallout, and there are lots of eyewitness accounts about the ash that fell for days after the Trinity test. And so this contaminated the cisterns. We know from studies that are currently being conducted that the dust from the plutonium particles from the fallout sometimes is still present in these areas 80 years later. And there's lots of studies and people interested in conducting these studies now that are finding such dust and contamination in high levels across New Mexico.
There was a Dr. Hempelman who was involved in studying the aftermath. What did he do? But more importantly, what is the infamous quote that you use in your book that comes from him?
Dr. Hempelman, one of the things that he said after the test is that a few people were probably overexposed, but they couldn't prove it, and we couldn't prove it. So we just assumed we got away with it. And that's essentially what happened. After the test, General Groves basically made a rule that no atmospheric nuclear tests could be conducted within a 150-mile population of any radius. One of the things that Groves said is that it was too small. The Trinity test site was too small to do another type of test of this magnitude. And of course, we know that they moved testing to the Pacific Islands and to later to the Nevada Proving Ground, Nevada test site, where they impacted other populations, right? Primarily indigenous populations in the South Pacific. And so the fact that they could admit that so soon after the test is overwhelming. The other sort of notable thing about that is when you consider that 150-mile radius. One of the things that I'm really interested in right now is that that 150-mile radius includes Mexico. It actually crosses international borders. And so that's something some of us are thinking about now. But There was a test, a reconstruction of the fallout map last summer, 2 summers ago, actually, at Princeton. And that map has proved really, really important using contemporary modeling software to show what a 150-mile radius and what that fallout map and that fallout cloud would have looked like. The original fallout map is so interesting when you look at it. And one of the most notable things about that is that the map, interestingly, goes around, circumvents the Mescalero Apache Reservation. And so all of these things are connected. Again, these are all part of environmental racism. And my belief is that it's also part of the reason why New Mexico and the Trinity Downwinders were left out of RECA for so long.
There was actually one study of the impact of the bomb on people that was done in the immediate aftermath of the bombing. What was that, and what was limiting about the people chosen?
There were actually three ranches that the Hempelman team returned to Trinity, to the vicinity of Trinity, to check on. One of the families, they actually didn't even know the ranch was there until afterward. But interestingly enough, about those three families is that they were all white families. But they also sort of ignored these families. Again, like I mentioned before, they barely checked on them for not a very long period. And then they said about a month after the Trinity shot was the last time they visited. And they noticed that there were two dogs that had started to limp. Their foot pads were raw and bleeding. And it was sort of these radiation burns that they had, as well as some goats that were there. And that was the last visit they made. Their observations from visiting that family were that the family didn't appear to be affected. And so they noticed at that time that there was a tin roof that water was dripping off of together in the cistern. And that should have been a sign for the federal government and for this medical team that they should have carried out studies. They would have found that there were communities nearby, way within that 150-mile radius, 30-mile radius, we're talking reasonably sized towns, who were affected. And these were towns who consisted of primarily Nuevo Mexicano, what we would call Hispanic today, communities that many who still considered themselves Mexican American in the 1940s and were primarily Spanish speaking.
With the recent passage of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, as you mentioned, it was just on July 3rd, and we're talking on July 15 of 2025. With the recent passage, which now does include New Mexico and Nuevo Mexicans, will that lead to writing an updated chapter to put in your book and a republication?
I hope so. I mean, what's fascinating is that my book was published in 2022. I finished writing it in 2021, and there are two chapters in there that are totally outdated at this point. One is the Trinity chapter because of the events with RECA, and that was quickly outdated because when RECA expired, essentially sunset last summer in 2024, it was really interesting because there was a group of us together at an event, or I was moderating the event, the discussion. And I said, today's June 7th, 2024, and RECA has officially expired. And it was like the sky wasn't falling. So what happens next? We were so frantic in thinking that once RECA expired, that was it. One thing that we've realized, in particular with this law, with this act, is that there are always other ways around circumventing these laws in the government, right? And so what they pursued was a reauthorization of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. And the politics of this are messy. The reauthorization of RECA was spearheaded by a bipartisan team of Senator Ben Ray Lujan from New Mexico and Josh Hawley from Missouri. Interestingly, what ended up happening, sort of in a last-minute move, is that the RECA reauthorization and expansion got tacked on to what was called, what is now called officially, the Big Beautiful Bill. There's nothing beautiful about that bill except to say that it includes the RECA coverage. And some of us are reeling trying to unpack what that means, that here we have an expansion and an extension and a reauthorization essentially to the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which now includes New Mexico downwinders. It now expands on the coverage for uranium workers, and it also includes communities like in St. Louis that were targeted for nuclear waste. And so, how do you contend with that when, in the same breath of this bill, things like Medicaid are cut? New Mexico leads the country in Medicaid debt right now, and many of the people who have been sick and eventually, unfortunately, even died as a result of illnesses that developed as a result of RICA have relied on Medicaid. And while there are so many other things to unpack with that bill, we can't deny that the RICA reauthorization is there. The government has provided no further instructions for potential claimants on how to pursue this. That's coming. But I can say that we've heard from people in New Mexico and various communities that these companies and these attorneys and these sort of third-party vultures have already started preying on New Mexicans, trying to be the intermediary to file paperwork for them on behalf of their families to the government. And so this is kind of an interesting component when you ask about revision to chapter four in my book on Trinity. The revision is sort of to include how that becomes part of this colonial conversation, these third-party vultures. So it's fascinating. You know, the other chapter that's outdated, of course, is the Holtec Project. And you just had Kevin Camps on the show a couple weeks ago after the Supreme Court decision. And so one of the things that I find myself always telling people is, yes, with Trinity and with the Manhattan Project and some of these things, we're talking about a history from 80 years ago. But this is in no way, shape, or form history to be forgotten in the past. We are still living this. It is still contemporary. And with the sort of new Manhattan Project that the federal government has embarked on with plutonium pit production, we're right in the middle of it again. Secretary Energy Wright was in Los Alamos in May, early May, and he stood in front of Oppenheimer's house for a press conference and said, "We're in a new Manhattan Project." The interesting thing about that is he was actually referring to AI, and we know that AI is a nuclear issue for lots of reasons, small modular reactors being one of them. That's such a distraction method from talking about the real Manhattan Project of nuclear weapons production that's ongoing, and it's ramped up and it's continuing to ramp up. Because the other thing this bill provided is the millions of dollars to support both Los Alamos and Savannah Riverside. So this isn't history. We're in it right now. If they create more nuclear weapons, new nuclear weapons, they're gonna probably have to do testing, and then we're back to the beginning. Yeah, Trinity is not really something that happened 80 years ago, even though it happened 80 years ago. We're all still living it and living with the ramifications of it today.
This sounds like it's the grounds for another book.
Yeah, right now I'm really interested in looking at the effects of the nuclear industrial complex on culture. It's something that I sort of talk around in my book, being really intimately familiar with it, but realizing that people had lots of questions about how and what this looks like, especially in New Mexico. And so right now I'm looking at cultural production by Chicanx people, Nuevo Mexicanos in particular, who write about and create art about the impact of the nuclear industrial complex on them, on their communities, on their families, and really thinking about what that impact on culture is and has been.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you would like to put in at this time?
One of the really interesting things to me has always been the coalitional work that has developed around frontline communities and indigenous communities impacted by nuclear industries. And I think there's some really remarkable partnerships and relationships that have developed. And I would just encourage people to continue that work. We really need to be working together if we want to see any sort of impact. We've come a long way, but this is only the beginning. Reauthorizing RICA and amending this is only the beginning. So I just want to thank everybody out there who is working toward rectifying some of these harms and trying to prevent future harms.
Mariah Gomez, your book is Nuclear Nuevo New Mexico. It is brilliantly well written, and I learned a tremendous amount about Trinity that I did not know beforehand, and I've done a lot of research on that area. Your work is important. You are important. And I'm grateful to you for making the time to talk with us this week for Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby.
Mariah Gomez. We will have a link up to her book. Nuclear Nuevo Mexico, Colonialism and the Effects of the Nuclear Industrial Complex on Nuevo Mexicanos, and it will be on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 733. So, what were the effects on the people of New Mexico who lived in proximity to the Trinity site? We learn some of that difficult truth in a very personal way from Bernice Gutierrez. She is a native New Mexican. received her degree in sociology with a concentration in criminal justice from the University of New Mexico, and has worked as a probation parole officer, paralegal, and social worker. She is also a board member of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium. I spoke with Bernice Gutierrez on July 14, 2025. Bernice Gutierrez, I am so grateful that you are joining us today here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much for your interest.
Where were you born and grow up, and what was your connection with the Trinity site?
I was born 8 days before they detonated the bomb at the Trinity site at the White Sands Missile Range in Alamogordo, New Mexico, in Carrizozo, which is about 35 miles from ground zero. All of my family lived there at that time. And while they always describe the area as remote and uninhabited, we know that's not true. We have since found out that there were ranches living as close as 12 miles, and within a 50-mile radius, there were 13,000 people living in the area. I'm a testament to that. I did not grow up in Carrizozo, New Mexico. We moved to Albuquerque when I was 2 years old. But by then it was too late. All of my family had been exposed to radiation, and we have since felt the repercussions of that exposure.
What was the impact of that exposure from the Trinity blast on your family?
Cancer. Lots of cancer. 5 generations of cancer. The cancer started with my great-grandfather, who died of stomach cancer in 1952. My mother suffered from 3 different cancers. She had thyroid, skin, and breast cancer. A brother had thyroid cancer. His youngest daughter had thyroid cancer, and about a year ago suffered from breast cancer. My only sister had 3 recurring exposures to thyroid cancer, with each one getting progressively worse. My other brother had prostate cancer. My youngest brother has thyroid disease, and on the recommendation of my endocrinologist, I had my thyroid removed. I had 3 children. My oldest son passed away in June of 2020 from myeloplastic dysplasia syndrome, which is a blood disorder that required he have a bone transplant that had to be done in Denver, Colorado, because they don't do that kind here in Albuquerque. He survived with that for about 10 months, and then he started getting sick. His oncologist had him go back to Denver, where he spent the last 2 months of his life. The last month of his life, he was on a ventilator in ICU. My only daughter survived thyroid cancer, and hopefully my youngest son hopefully won't ever get any type of radiogenic disease, but we here in this area never say if, we always wonder when. I have 6 grandkids, 2 great-granddaughters, and it's a stress, always wondering and praying that they don't get it.
I am so sorry that that happened to you and to your family. And unfortunately, it's not in the past tense, because who knows what's coming next. I know you have been active with the Tularosa Basin Downwinders. When and how did you get involved with them?
One of my endocrinologists asked me if my family had ever been exposed to radiation. I didn't have a clue. I never learned about the bomb and the possibilities of what it could do if we were exposed to radiation. They don't teach it in school. And it wasn't until I was watching TV one evening and I saw Tina Cordova on the news, and she was talking about an upcoming event that the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium was going to have. She talked about downwind of the bomb and the exposure to radiation. I got on the internet, looked up her information, called her, explained my family medical history, and the rest is history. I went to the event, learned so much about the possible explanation of why we were all getting so much cancer. So I became involved with them. This was about 10 years ago, and have been on the steering committee since then.
You have also done research that has been very important and comes into alignment with some of the work that was done by the late Kitty Tucker, who was the wife of the just recently deceased Bob Alvarez, about infant mortality. What was the work that you did?
We received his peer report, and that piqued my interest to look into specifically New Mexico for 1945. So I researched every death certificate in 1945 for infants a year and younger. I was able to access all but eight counties because the information was so blurry I couldn't make it out. So I did research on church records because the Catholics go to the church because they need to bury their babies. What I found was the church records did not have death certificates. The majority of them did not have death certificates. So I know that the research is not complete. But like, for example, in Carrizozo, where I was born, in 1944, there was only two babies that died. In 1945, 10 died.
And of course, infants are the most vulnerable to the impact of radiation. That was also part of Kitty Tucker's research that we will link to with this program because she discovered a tremendous correlation between exposure to radiation from the Trinity blast and the deaths of infants in your area.
Right, and I also listed their cause of death. And it's very, very similar. There's a lot of similarities in the causes of death for these babies. And many, many were also born premature. And we feel that that's because the mother's reproductive organs were contaminated. And we also came across many that had congenital deformities.
What has the activity of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium and yourself been as we are coming up to the 80th anniversary of that bomb going off?
Well, we are currently going to have a major event in celebration. Well, if you want to call it a celebration of the 80th anniversary, our New Mexico legislature put in a request and it was approved. And we are going to have a memorial put up in front of the Trinity site. It is going to explain the downwinder history with some accurate information on one side, and on the back side, it's going to have a map of the area of New Mexico in 1945 based on a census record for the 1940s.
And that is going to indicate where the wind blew and where the radiation cloud went.
Oh no, that's only going to tell you how many people were living in the area. But we were fortunate enough. We've had many scientists take an interest in our history, and the scientists from Princeton University, based on today's technology, did a meteorological study of the weather patterns for July 16th, 1945. And what they discovered is that the exposure, the fallout, not only covered New Mexico, but covered 46 other states, Canada, and Mexico. They have since updated their research and found that the two states that were the most exposed to the fallout were New Mexico and Nevada, with Nevada receiving the majority of it and New Mexico right behind.
What do you hope the attention on Trinity and this memorial that is going on, what do you hope that that will accomplish?
Many, many people go to the Trinity site when it's open. Used to be open twice a year, and for some reason they've cut it down to once a year. But every time the gates are open, we go out there and we do what we call a peaceful protest. And during these past few years that we've been doing it, we have distributed information, educational information about the true story, because people have come back out from the Trinity site and told us that the historian that was in there did not describe the accurate history.
Didn't mention downwinders and the impact of the radiation and the fallout.
No, not at all. So we were there doing that. And as a result, last year when we went in October, we found that more and more, because it's amazing how many thousands of cars go in there on that day. But we're noticing that less and less New Mexico plates are going in there. We have counted the plates. 46 or 47 of the states have been accounted for. They get a ton of visitors when it's open. And I can understand why. It's a historical site. But the sad thing is, even though it's a historical site, it hasn't been an accurate retelling of the history.
And is it still radiologically active? Is there danger in the dust and in the soil and in the air on the Trinity site?
We believe it is because we have had people go in there with Geiger counters and come back out and tell us that there's hot spots there. So apparently there is still radiation inside that site. The half-life of plutonium, which was in the bomb, is 24,000 years. But there was not only plutonium, that was not the only element that was in the bomb. There was strontium and celcium, and those half-lives are pretty long too. So we feel that there is still contamination in the wind. Every time the wind blows from the white sands, from the dust, because New Mexico is known for its dust storms, and we feel it is still being distributed. We also have another scientist by the name of Dr. Michael Ketterer, who has taken some samples of soil and has found that the area around Los Alamos in Acid Canyon has the most plutonium ever. Now, this study was done maybe just a few months ago. He said there is more plutonium present in that canyon than there was in Chernobyl.
We've had Dr. Ketterer on the show several times, and he's always a source of shocking and important information. In addition to the unveiling of the monument at Trinity, there are also going to be events involving Catholic bishops. Tell us what that is about.
Archbishop Wester and Bishops Baldacchino and Walls. Baldacchino's from Las Cruces and Walls is from Gallup. They're going to be going inside the Trinity site. And I'm imagining praying. We had hoped to be able to be included in that and have them come out and do the blessing of the memorial. But apparently, time's not going to permit. But they are going to be going and giving Mass in Tula Rosa that evening at 6. We are going to follow that service with the reception and then follow that with our 16th annual candlelight vigil. Our vigil, we light a luminaria for every name of every deceased person from cancer, and we read off their names to make sure that they're never forgotten.
Wow. Going forward, what actions are planned by the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium, and what do you hope can still be achieved in terms of spreading awareness of the event and its impact on the human beings, on the life that was living around it?
Well, for the first time in our history, on July 3rd of this year, we were finally accepted into the RECA program and are going to start receiving compensation for New Mexicans. The bill that it was included in is also going to cut Medicaid, the SNAP program, and some Medicare. So, unfortunately, our inclusion into RECA had to be made with some compromise, one of which was healthcare was stripped out of it. So if healthcare is stripped out of the RECA program and New Mexico and all the rest of the country experiences a cut in Medicaid, New Mexicans are going to be in a world of hurt because 47% of New Mexico is on Medicaid.
If you could say anything to those who are right now still, and it seems forever, promoting nuclear weapons in particular, as somehow necessary to the safety of this country, what would you say to them?
Don't do it. The nuclear weapons has damaged many, many people, My family included, and my family's only one of thousands with a history like mine. And we know they are wanting to start up nuclear testing again. And we know that Los Alamos is currently making plutonium pits. And all we can hope and pray for is that they don't do it. They haven't even fixed the last problem they created. We don't need to create additional problems.
Bernice, you have been very generous with your time and your information. My heart goes out to you and your family for what you have been through. And I thank you so much for being to share so honestly and so directly with the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much for your interest.
Bernice Gutierrez. We will have a link up to the cornerstone research on infant mortality after the atomic bomb explosion that was mentioned in this interview. It was by Kitty Tucker, and the title is Trinity, the Most Significant Hazard of the Entire Manhattan Project. It will be linked on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 733. This special report on Trinity at 80, New Mexico downwinder radiation victims set the record straight, will continue in just a moment. But first, the 80 years since the Trinity atomic bomb explosion is a nuclear anniversary with a year count that ends in zero. And that flipped odometer means the media is going to be going nuts, cranking out stories about the first atomic bomb. But while the majority of these will focus on the supposed glory of that example of the rocket's red glare, most will be rehashing existing narratives, focusing on Oppenheimer, Groves, technology, with a side helping of current nuclear threats. What will they be missing? The human story of the victims of that first atomic blast, downwinders. The original name for Trinity was Jornada del Muerto, Dead Man's Trail. Appropriate, don't you think? General Leslie Groves chose it for the detonation because he considered it remote and uninhabited. But thousands of people lived within a 50-mile radius of the blast, and none of them was not affected by the radioactive fallout that followed. These downwinders were unwilling, unknowing, and uncompensated for what they went through. And while there is now at least the promise of some compensation from the government through RICA, many still consider it too little, too late. Giving a voice to these long-ignored nuclear survivors is one of the missions of Nuclear Hot Seat, to share the stories about nuclear that mainstream media either avoids or ignores. So I ask that on this, the anniversary of the start of our nuclear madness, if you appreciate the work that we do, please help Nuclear Hot Seat keep going. We are funded solely by donations, and as a 501c3 nonprofit organization, anything you donate is tax deductible. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, or if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Any amount helps us keep producing programs such as this one. So go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate what you can. And however you can help, know that I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now back to this week's Trinity Anniversary Special. Tina Cordova is a sixth-generation native New Mexican born and raised in the small town of Tularosa in south-central New Mexico. In 2005, Tina co-founded the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium with the late Fred Tyler. Tina has been an unstoppable campaigner for the rights of those harmed by radiation who were downwind of the Trinity atomic bomb blast, and she is an honored leader for us all. I spoke with Tina Cordova on July 14, 2025. Tina Cordova, in many ways, when it comes to the work around Trinity, you are the mother of us all. And with the passage of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act about 2 weeks ago now, something that you have been fighting for years, what does that mean to the struggle around Trinity?
Well, I will tell you that the acknowledgement has meant a great deal to not only me, but everybody that I've spoken to. And
That was an amazing big first step. But we're not there yet. They have only given us a 2-year extension, which will not be enough time for the people in New Mexico, tens of thousands of people in New Mexico who will want to and should apply to the program and receive compensation. 2 years is far too little time for people to gather records that are in some cases 80 years old. So you can imagine the obstacle there. So the 2-year extension is, we're grateful for this. It's a wonderful acknowledgement. It's the first time the government has ever acknowledged that they harmed us. And we will continue to fight. We would like to see a long-term extension, and we would also like to see them put the health care coverage back into the bill. It passed with health care coverage last year out of the U.S. Senate, and obviously one of the things they've told us forever is that it's going to cost too much. It's just unacceptable that they've stripped out the health care coverage when that is probably what is most important to us as people who are sick and dying. So we will take the win. And we will dust ourselves off in a couple of days and pick up where we were right before they passed this and keep on going. And not only for those two reasons, but because they have, again, arbitrarily left out people like our sisters and brothers in Guam, who we have lobbied with side by side, who we have stayed in Airbnbs with all over, who are now like family to us. And we can never look away from the fact that we have now left them out, left out the people in Colorado and Montana, in all of Arizona that wasn't included, all of Nevada that wasn't included. And so we have work ahead of us, but we're grateful for this. We'll take this win. It's a gigantic step forward. They've opened the door to us, and we believe that now we will walk through and we will continue to ask for more, for what we deserve, and for what the people that have been left out deserve.
With this being the 80th anniversary of the detonation of the bomb at Trinity, what is the significance of this anniversary for you?
It is amazing that it took 80 years for the stars to align for us. You know, people said to me over and over at the end of last year when we came so close and we didn't manage to pull it off, people were so horribly disappointed. People said to me over and over, it's not going to happen. We're going to wait again for years. It's just not going to happen. And I said, you know, we're not in a worse place. We're not in a better place. We're in this place. And there will come a day when the stars align. And it happened, July 3rd. And so, you know, the 80th anniversary seems to have brought about some interesting recognition because also for the first time ever, the state of New Mexico is placing a sign, a permanent sign, at the entrance to the Trinity site where people stop and look at the historic marker that's there that pays homage to the science and the scientists. But there's never been a mention of us. And now we will have our permanent sign placed there that will acknowledge the sacrifice and the suffering of the people of New Mexico who were enlisted into the service of that bomb. Without consent, without knowledge, and who've been dying ever since. And so the 80th anniversary brings a tremendous amount of recognition and acknowledgement for us this year.
Dana, your work through the years has been magnificent. You have been a true leader for people when they needed it. I know it hasn't been easy for you because it never is, but you've done it. Congratulations on how far this has gone. And let's keep working. We'll support you here at Nuclear Hot Seat and do whatever is possible to help you move forward to whatever the next milestone is.
Well, thank you, Libby. You know, as I do, that we dedicate ourselves to these things and it becomes long-term and it becomes our life's work. You have done just the same thing that I have chosen to do. And so I appreciate you very much. I appreciate the lens that you have placed on this for us and all the times that you've allowed us to tell our history, especially at times when people didn't want to hear it. And so thank you, thank you, thank you. And we send you our regards.
My heart to you as well. Tina Cordova. You can find out more about her work and the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium on their website, trinitydownwinders.com. And now here's my contribution to the Trinity story. It starts with a question. How do you hide an atomic bomb blast in plain sight? The answer is a saga of media manipulation embedded into the nuclear story since before the bomb test at Trinity on July 16, 1945. No one knew about the top-secret Manhattan Project to build the world's first atomic bomb. The project had remained so successfully hidden that even Vice President Harry Truman didn't learn of it until after President Roosevelt died and he took on the top spot. The scientists knew that when the first bomb was exploded, people would know. And there was no way to deny that some massive explosion had happened in the middle of New Mexico. But how to cover it up? Bury the story? That was the question. The answer was provided by a New York Times science reporter embedded into the Manhattan Project, William L. Lawrence. He'd been hired in May 1945 by General Leslie Groves, head of the Manhattan Project. Lawrence's job? To disappear into the Manhattan Project and, in complete secrecy, write multiple stories on what it took to create the bomb. In other words, propaganda. Though Lawrence saw it as simple reporting on the biggest story of his life. None of his articles was to be released for publication until after the bomb was used on Japan. Every day, his writing was locked in a safe in General Groves's office, and his draft pages were burned to ash by locals chosen specifically for the task. That's because they were illiterate. I discovered this story, initially with the help of award-winning environmental journalist Carl Grossman. In the first year of producing Nuclear Hot Seat, preparing for my first show on Trinity, I learned that a press release about the Trinity explosion was written before the blast happened, when no one knew what the results would be. That's not the way journalism is supposed to work on breaking news stories. You wait until something has happened, and then you write about it. Then I learned from Carl that more than one press release had been prepared. 4, to cover all possible results. The first one? Munitions dump explosion in the middle of the desert. No injuries, only minor on-site damage, no danger to the public. Number 2. Munitions dump explosion. No deaths, some injuries, on-site damage, no danger to the public. Number 3. Munitions dump explosion, major damage, some serious injuries, a few deaths. Still, no danger to the public. And number 4, major destruction. Munitions dump explosion, major destruction. Many dead, including several of the world's leading scientists. Lawrence was not allowed to mention the word radiation in any of his writing, let alone what it did. So he cited the danger from, quote, poison gas release. And this required martial law to be declared and portions of New Mexico evacuated. Quite a range of possibilities. And before the explosion, no one knew which it would be. In the end, Lawrence's second press release was sent out. Munitions dump explosion, some damage, a few injuries, no danger to the public. Nothing to worry your pretty little head about. It successfully disguised the nature and importance of the atomic bomb explosion and made the story of only minor interest in the local news and irrelevant to any publication east of the Mississippi. It was simply ignored. This information and other examples of Lawrence's atomic journalistic malfeasance became the key and the core of a play that I've written, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. It spells out the whole story of how Lawrence, forever nicknamed Atomic Bill, transformed from a respected science reporter to a nuclear shill and propagandist who compromised his journalistic ethics in order to own the story of the bomb. There were many unforeseen consequences for him, some might call it karma, but the legacy of this nuclear cover-up remains with us today, especially in our inability to understand what radiation is and what it does. All of this is detailed in my play, And I'm proud to let you know that Atomic Bill and the Payment Due will receive its world premiere stage reading at the Peace Resource Center of Wilmington College in Ohio. The event will be on September 9 at 7:30 p.m. as a featured component of the PRC's 50th anniversary celebration. It's in a 400-seat theater, and admission is free. So as we acknowledge the 80th anniversary of the Trinity Atomic Bomb Blast and the start of the Atomic Age, by the way, that's a phrase that Lawrence coined, we need to also be aware that hiding nuclear dangers, misreporting them, preventing the public from getting the full unadulterated truth, has been hardwired into the U.S. government policy for 80 years, longer if you count the complete silence surrounding the Manhattan Project from its birth. When you wonder why people did not know back then what was happening, that's why. And undoubtedly that blackout of honest nuclear news continues to this day. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat is here, to help pierce the omerta, the veil of silence that obscures nuclear threats and makes us not even think about wanting to know. But here at Nuclear Hot Seat, we do. And we will continue to share what it is we learn with you every week for as long as we can. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 15, 2025. Clearly, we do not have the time to share with you the information about the Church Rock Uranium Tailings Pond breach and disaster, which took place on another July 16, this one in 1979. However, a full-length special program was produced on it, and we will link to it on the website, nuclearhotseat.com. Again, this episode is number 733. And that way you can learn about the other July 16 nuclear disaster. Our thanks to Leona Morgan for her help with this week's show. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a yellow opt-in box that you cannot miss. Just put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one email, just one, with the link to that week's show and a short description of its content. That way, you never miss another show ever again. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information to us in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount helps us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat reminding you, we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with a date that it's over, because once it starts, it is never over. There it is, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.